After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, a bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. "Get up," he said, "don't be afraid." When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, "Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead."
Thank you, Barbara. And if you have your Bible, you might turn to Matthew chapter 17. And if you were inclined, maybe 2 Peter chapter 1. You know, I'm going to say a word of thanks. You know, on Wednesdays, we have, of course, folks who come and they get a box of food, and they may, if it's the letter matches their last name that's available for that week, they'll get some clothes. But we also have a group of people who make it a point to tell children story and then give them an opportunity for a craft. And I'll probably miss all of those who help, but Janine and Jenny and Jeff Coyne, I know, are the three driving forces behind that group. And it's fun. I stuck my head in this Wednesday. I needed to tell Janine something, and there was a table full of children who were working on a craft or working on a coloring picture, and they have an opportunity each week to hear a good news story. And so if you see them, thank them for the time they take. And if you'd like to be involved in doing that, I'm sure they would welcome you to come and join them. Would you pray with me, please? Holy One, the one whom Peter called majestic glory, the world is all grown up. Well, at least it thinks it is. Satisfied with how much we know and all that we have accomplished, we get swept up in the glory of our own mountains. Even still, we try harder, often afraid we'll get passed by. Bring us rest, your light, and your presence in the good news that is Jesus the Christ. And all God's people say. Amen. Fleming Rutledge, who is either 82 or 83, I don't know because her birthday isn't listed in Wikipedia, but was born in 1937 and was probably one of the more prominent women to serve as a rector or pastor or parish priest over a church in the Northeast. She was relaying a story in a sermon from 1999, and it goes something like this. A good friend of mine is a rector of a church in the Massachusetts Berkshires. She tells a story about her husband and his Sunday school class. Her husband is a physics professor at Williams College. He was teaching a class on the Transfiguration to some 12 to 13-year-olds. As he relayed the story of how Jesus' clothing turned brilliant white, Moses and Elijah appeared, and so forth, one of the boys said, "Mr. Crampton, I don't believe that story, and neither do you. The world is all grown up." Many find the stories that we find in the Scriptures too fantastical to believe anymore. They just don't fit the body of knowledge that we have assembled as human beings. And even if there are bits we cannot explain, we no longer find it fashionable to say, well, there's a transcendent force or maybe God at work. I mean, even 12 to 13-year-olds know that. Seems some of us being those of us who find ourselves here or in any church on any given Sunday, seem a little bit embarrassed to admit that we do really believe some of these stories that sound awful, outlandish, fantastical. we worry that some do think that we believe in some fairy tales. So we don't talk about it much outside of our group. We don't talk about these kinds of stories. We're afraid of what people might say. I mean, we've heard the question. You've heard the question. I've heard the question. Do you literally believe that? From skeptics, from cynics. But you know it like me, don't you? It's a trap question. It seems they've been following Jesus' skill at question asking, trying to get us whether we say yes or no. I mean, if we answer yes, we're dismissed as believing in some fairy tales. If we answer no, then we're quizzed about why in the world are you still participating in a local church? The consequence is that those who seem to have no trouble believing are not sure what to do about those among us who have trouble believing. So what if those who have no trouble created space for those who do? I mean, it might take some work, but a rediscovery of what one writer called a second naivete actually makes space given or for the doubting and may make for a more imaginative witness to a world that's all grown up. Today is Transfiguration Sunday. We mentioned it early in the prayer. Nathan offered a prayer for Transfiguration Sunday. It is the Sunday set aside prior to Lent that marks the moment where in all the Gospels we hear the words that Jesus set his face toward Jerusalem. Now, if you're keeping track of how that works, Matthew, for instance, is almost split in two in terms of Jesus' ministry up to this point, and then what happens? He's heading toward Jerusalem, and just prior to this chapter, chapter 16, is one of the last times, or maybe one of the continuing times, where Jesus tells his disciples that the Son of Man must suffer. He'll be arrested, he'll be crucified, and rise again. And you may remember Peter's response, "Oh, that's not going to happen to you." And Jesus' retort, you remember it? Anybody? "Get behind me, Satan, for you don't have in mind the things of God." That's kind of the groundwork laid for us leading into this chapter. But in the Christian calendar, Transfiguration sets us up to know that we are but a short time away from Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, Black Saturday, and Easter Sunday. 40 days are given to reflect and think about our own lives. Investigate some of those places and spaces in our own living where we too, like the disciples maybe, like the Israelites even, who may have failed in keeping faithfulness. This day really kind of a benchmark moment. The other thing we could say about it is Transfiguration Sunday, like the Sunday just weeks ago that we recall the baptism of Jesus, is one of the only two times in the New Testament where we hear actually God say something. All the other times, the writer of Hebrews has made the point that God is speaking to us in His Son. But two times, at the baptism and at the Mount of Transfiguration, we hear God, the voice, what Peter referred to as majestic glory, say, "This is my Son in whom I'm well pleased," two times. Must mean that God is trying to say something about the Son. Maybe that we should hear Him. After all, that is what one of the gospel writers records was included in those words, "Listen to Him." This transfiguration of Jesus, this fantastical story that Mr. Crampton's Sunday school class, those 12 to 13-year-olds had a hard time believing, and he was challenged as to whether he even believed it, is one of the few events that are particularly verified in the Scriptures. I mean, of all the things in Jesus' life that could be recounted by one of the disciples, one who walked with Jesus, aside from the resurrection, of all the things you and I could think about, this is one of the few, if not the only, that one of the disciples pointed back to make a point. And Peter did that in our reading of 2 Peter. It was for this week, there in chapter 1. Peter is wanting to make sure that those to whom he's writing are connecting what God has been doing, that he's been doing it in Jesus. So he wrote this, "For he received honor and glory from God the Father when that voice was conveyed to him by the majestic glory, saying, 'This is my Son, my beloved, with whom I'm well pleased.'" Here's what he says. "We ourselves heard this voice come from heaven while we were with him on the holy mountain." So here it is. We are a people who think that truth is either something that can be falsified or verified. That is the place we are in a grown-up world. If you can prove it false or you can prove it true, that then gives you some reason to say, oh, there must be something to it. Is it verifiable? And here's Peter. We like eyewitness stories. We like stories today, but some reason, when we find it in the Bible, it's met with as much skepticism as, well, in any other reason we might have to be skeptical or cynical about something someone says. But here's Peter. We heard that voice. We were there. And so Peter is calling back to this event. What's interesting is the verse that kind of started our reading for today there in 1 Peter chapter 1 starts this way. "Therefore, I intend to keep on reminding you of these things, though you know them already and are established in the truth that has come to you." A grown-up world. A world that's grown up, familiar with the language and the vocabulary of faith. It's been wired into our culture for more than 200 years. Even now that it has kind of distanced itself from that, even now that folks kind of want to resist that particular influence, even we who are in church who aren't sure some days about some of the stories that we read need to be reminded. Peter thought it was important to remind us. Some wonder, why do we still get together week after week? Well, it's because there are forces out there who want to tell us that there isn't any good that could come from us unless we just really work hard, unless we meet all the expectations that our in-group says we ought to meet, unless we really are achieving, unless we are wealthy, unless we can have something to show for it. And we need to be reminded week in and week out what God has done for us in Christ, because it's utterly exhausting trying to measure up to your own expectations or what you perceive to be the pastor's expectations or what you perceive to be the expectations of someone sitting on your row or across the room. It's exhausting. So Peter wants to remind us he reminds those exiles that really who we should focus our attention on is the one to whom the voice pointed us, "My Son, in whom I'm well pleased," one we should listen to. Peter knew it was important. Hearing Jesus over and over and over again say to his disciples, "I'm going to suffer, I'm going to die, and I'm going to rise," was nothing short of an agitation. They had found in Jesus their hope, and the idea that he would somehow disappear, somehow be removed from the scene, somehow be erased from their story was just incredulous. They could not believe it, didn't want it. Remember again, it was Peter who denied Jesus when the time came. He had forgot all that he had in mind, all that he had experienced, warming himself by the fire. "Aren't you one who was with him?" "No," he said. "No," he repeated. And now, writing to a group of people who are scattered, he remembers. He's reminded. Before the world grew up and got all adultish and big, it was described as an enchanted world. And that is that we used to understand our limitations. That is what we didn't know. But now that we know all that we do, we don't really need to attribute anything that we see or anything that goes on in the world around us to some sort of transcendent force or some God. Voices from heaven, transformed clothing, the appearance of two other figures with someone that we know and just been talking with. They sure must be the imaginings of someone who's inebriated. But remember, Peter would be accused of that, right? Standing to preach on the day of Pentecost, everyone felt like he had Well, he had had a little bit too much before 9 o'clock in the morning. What Peter was drunk on, if he was drunk on anything, was the fresh reality of what forgiveness meant to someone who had betrayed Jesus, someone who couldn't remember well what Jesus had told him, now realizes after the fact, this is what we ought to tell people about. So isn't it interesting that in this transfiguration moment, Jesus had given the disciples, don't tell anyone until after the resurrection. So we find it in the Gospels and only in Peter's second letter. Peter is, for all of us, kind of an inkblot character. He's kind of someone we look at and go, how do we compare to him? Are we like him? So some of us like Peter because he's so all over the place. Some days doubting, some days defiant, some days faithful. He's a bit of everywhere. We like him. We don't really want everyone to think that we're all over the place. We want people to think that we're even keel, we got it all together. We don't want them to know that there are days. There are days where we doubt and we're frustrated and they were faithless. But there are days where we're faithful and trustworthy. Peter opens his letter to the exiles who have been chosen and destined by God the Father and sanctified by the Spirit to be obedient to Jesus Christ and to be sprinkled with his blood. Now, I've got this really well worked out thing to go from here, but I think I'm going to insert something that happened this morning. Just so you know that sometimes the pastor can kind of give in to the thought that maybe the Spirit says, hi, here's a better illustration than what you thought about. So we have had fun teaching the third and fourth graders. Or I should say, I've had fun watching Patty teach the third and fourth graders while I clean up ice on the floor, throw away the trash, and make sure that if the decibel level sneaks up a little high, we can kind of bring it back down just a hair. But today we were talking about the story of the angel who told Joseph and Mary that not to return back to Bethlehem or even to Nazareth because of Herod's pursuit to kill him. And it dawned on me as we were telling that story, just three verses in Matthew this morning, we were just talking with the third and fourth graders, and then we were telling them this, that one thing that happens here is there is this line, out of Egypt I have called my son. That's how, I believe it's verse 15 in Matthew 2 ends. Out of Egypt I've called my son. And I realized that, well, what we mentioned with the children just a minute ago is that what happens in the life of Jesus is Jesus is reenacting the drama of Israel in his own life. So when we hear a phrase that says, this is because of what was said, out of Egypt I've called my son, immediately we're not sure what to do with that, except if you were Jewish, you'd immediately call back to the Exodus and to Egypt, and you'd immediately remember that Israel had once been called or referred to as God's son or God's child. So as a collective group of people in Israel, God's son was in Israel. God's child, it was in Egypt. God's child was in Egypt. And they needed to be set free. And so he raises up Moses, yes? Raises up Moses, says, let my people go. And Moses leads God's son, that imagery, his son out of Egypt. Out of Egypt I called my son. So here's what Matthew does in telling the story. He says, this, now we're going to tie it to a past experience, a past story, something you're very familiar with. Jesus is going to go into Egypt because there's the threat of Herod who wants to kill the king. Because Herod is afraid he'll lose his palace, he'll lose his power, and he'll lose his people. And so after about 3.5 years, it's okay to go back home. But Matthew makes it clear to say they went to Egypt because it was written, out of Egypt I called my son. Now some of us have grown up thinking, wow, that means that God fulfilled a prophecy. What that means is, or what that says rather, is Jesus is reenacting a story that they're familiar with. And while Moses led the people out of Egypt, they returned to captivity over and over and over and over again. They were subject to themselves and their poor decisions, and they were subject to other nation-state powers. And so they were in and out of that same experience over and over and over again. So the gospel writers want us to say, it comes to an end. The oppression that human beings face and that this nation faces is over in Jesus. Out of Egypt, I called my son. When you read sprinkled by his blood, we've all grown up and we don't need blood. Talk about blood is icky. We can't talk about it. But when Peter uses that language, he's calling back to Exodus 24. And in Exodus 24, the scene is the people are at the foot of Mount Sinai. It's that point where Moses is going to go up on the mountain and receive the tablets of the law. And before they start, Moses gathers all the people. He's got the 70 elders. He's got his main guys with him. It's listed there in the text. And he then says, here's all that God requires. Here's God's covenant. Here's God's commands. And all together the people say, all that you have spoken, we will do. And Moses takes some of the blood from the sacrifice and he dashes it in one translation, but he sprinkles it out. It's like today I would be casting it out. Here's what God requires. And you would say, all that you have said, we will do. And so as an affirmation of the covenant, the blood that represents life is sprinkled because you're going to have life if you keep these words. Well, how successful was that? They kept all the words, didn't they? I mean, their history and experience in the wilderness is full of faithfulness, right? I mean, everywhere you turn, they were singing great songs to God, and they were excited about the food. Yeah? They couldn't wait to get to the land of promise. That's why they were afraid, because they were viewed as grasshoppers compared to the size of the people when they scouted out the land. They were faithful. No. So when Peter says, sprinkled with the blood of Christ, he's calling back to Exodus 24, and as he calls back, he says, listen, the law was never intended to be the means whereby you could prove how good you are and how faithful you are. In fact, if there's anything you and I know about the law, it really is that it points up that we aren't perfect. I don't get a whole lot of agreement. That really is the only function the law has. There are 10 commandments, then they turn to 615, and now we have our own. Some are written, some aren't. Some are socially constructed, some are traditionally conditioned. But whatever they are, you and I understand how exhausting it is to try to live up under the law. Whether it's the 10 commandments or any other law that you feel the weight of by a group you participate in. It's exhausting. No amount of trying to do better is going to achieve better, because we just have to admit that we're human. So in this recreation that Peter has in this, it also then, because Peter's referring us to the transfiguration, well, now maybe if you go back and read Exodus 24, you're going to see the parallels with Matthew 17. They're both going up mountains. There's both an incredible glow of glory. In Exodus, there's a cloud and consuming fire. In Matthew, there is the brilliant light. In Exodus, there is the giving of the Ten Commandments, and on the Mount of Transfiguration, there's the affirmation that Jesus is the good news, not the law. And so, the Gospels are pointing out that Jesus is retelling us a better story. So when we read the Bible and we like to famously lay it on thick that we believe it literally, we may need to be literal minded. Here's the difference. The difference is that when we read the opening verse of chapter 17, after 6 days, first thing we do is go back and find out what happened 6 days before. Because literally we're concerned. It says after 6 days, so what's the event that happened 6 days before? Good luck to you. But 6 days, tell me, where does 6 days, what sort of bell does 6 days ring for you? Genesis. On the sixth day, God created human beings. After 6 days, Jesus goes on the mountain. I've been told that Jewish rabbis have a saying that when Adam sinned, the glory fell from Adam as the crown of God's creation, or the brightness from Adam. So here is Jesus taken up on the mountain, takes his three inner circle, and he gets up to the mountain after 6 days. Literally, it's after 6 days, so we'll look for the chronology, what happened before, but a Jewish ears ready to see or hear what's being said are going to go, this is something about Adam. So Jesus restores Adam's glory, human beings' glory. And then with Moses and Elijah there, the lawgiver and the prophet of the law, he is the one who is greater than Moses. Because when the light goes away, who's left? Moses is gone, and Elijah is gone, and all that's left is Jesus. We've been there. Last two Sundays, we've talked about our righteous needing to exceed the scribes and the Pharisees, that Jesus came to fulfill the law. And there he is in that vision. He filled up what was lacking in Adam, and he demonstrated that he was greater than Moses, that if there is a law to keep, he can do it. And he did it for us. What are the takeaways for us on Transfiguration Sunday? What are the things we could say? Because after all, in a grown-up world, what are the things available to us? Because in a grown-up world where we can look everywhere else for the answers, what is the key? What is the story saying to us? Well, two things happen. Peter is really fired up. I mean, if you go from one minute being called Satan to the next minute getting the privilege of this kind of secret meeting between Jesus and Elijah and Moses, you kind of you feel pretty good about yourself. So realizing that it's something special, he blurts out, well, let's make three tabernacles, three tents, three shelters, one for Moses, Jesus, and one for Elijah. And let's just hang out here and worship a while. In Exodus 24, the next thing that happens in verse 25 is God gives the instructions for the tabernacle. The tabernacle is that dwelling, that mobile worship center. That big tent that travels around in the wilderness with the people, where God is a cloud by day and a fire by night, where the tent of meeting is out front, and the cloud comes down as Moses enters the tent of meeting. It is an expression of the presence of God. Tabernacle. Well, Israel had developed a feast called the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles. And they would go out and they would rest from all the harvesting, all the farming, all the busy work, and they would rest for a period of time in these booths. And Peter may be indicating that, man, it'd be great to rest. We've been chasing you around for a while. You've been telling us all sorts of stuff that's going to change the world. You've been talking about dying and rising. We've seen you serve and minister to thousands of people, changing their lives. We're pretty exhausted. It'd be pretty cool to rest right here. Before there was any occasion, the brightness, the brilliance disappears, and it's only Jesus. Those three are cowering in fear. And Jesus reaches out and touches them. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Let me suggest that if we're calling back and forth between Exodus and Matthew, if Jesus is retelling the story, if God is recreating something new in Jesus and communicating it with all the trappings of their history, he's letting them know what the writer of Hebrews says. There is, therefore, a Sabbath rest for the people of God. There is a rest. Peter was right. We ought to rest in what Jesus has done for us. And sometimes we fall into the trap of thinking that the things that we do are the things that somehow keep us in God's pleasure. Listen, this isn't to say that there aren't things we ought to be obedient about. You can't read 2 Peter and not come away feeling like, man, I really need to be faithful. But your faithfulness is predicated on the faithfulness already charted for us in Jesus, not as though your faithfulness is somehow going to merit you something. And so Peter knew people need rest, folks. Sitting down with folks over coffee, over a meal, or as they come in on Wednesdays or wherever you encounter them, people need some rest. Aren't you exhausted a little bit? Yeah. So there is a good message of good news for folks who are trying to live at such a breakneck pace, filling out all the expectations of everyone else to be told there's good news. In Christ, you get to rest. You get to rest. And in your resting, you get to work. I know that sounds a little bit like a paradox or a contradiction, but Jesus then takes the disciples off the mountain, and the first thing he does is find people who he needs to touch and care for. So the message is, in our resting, we have opportunity to come alongside folks and be God's presence to them, be his light for them, point them to God's faithfulness to them in Jesus. You know, I thought about titling this message, Go Rest High on That Mountain, but you all would think we were having a funeral service. But in some regards, it actually is a little bit of that, by the way. Because we're always looking to build our own mountains. Because we're afraid that if we don't get them built, no one's going to think we're worth a whole lot. But the song that Glenn read when we began this morning is a song that says, God's got a better mountain than any that you could build, and he's invited us to come up and share it with him. So there is for us a place of rest and a place of love. That is to reach out and to be God's presence. So why don't we rest high on his mountain while we yet have time to do so? Because there are plenty of folks who you're going to meet this week who are just exhausted. And you've got some good news for them. There's rest in Jesus.